Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's the commitment we made.
In his first trip to Asia as president, Joe Biden's promise to defend Taiwan militarily if it's invaded by China. The White House took back his words, but was it a gaffe by the president or a new U.S. policy? We'll talk about Biden's trip, Taiwan, and today's meeting of the Quad, India, Australia, Japan, and the U.S. China's criticized the Quad as the Indo-Pacific version of NATO. Plus, we look at The Ransom, a new series in the New York Times detailing how France devastated Haiti's economy by forcing Haiti to pay massive reparations for the loss of slave labor after enslaved Haitians rebelled, founding the world's first black republic in 1804.
The New York Times article that was published this weekend, I think, will shed light on the very question of what makes the case of Haiti what we see today in terms of this country that people often refer to as the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations says the number of people displaced by war, conflict, and human rights abuses has topped 100 million for the first time. UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, announced the grim milestone as he met with Rohingya refugees who fled violence and government persecution in Burma.
Much as we're all focusing on Ukraine as a catastrophic emergency, we must not forget that there's other critical situations in the world that need attention and resources.
In Burma, at least 17 Rohingya, including three children, drowned after their boat capsized off the coast over the weekend. Dozens more are missing and fear dead. It's believed the Rohingya were attempting to cross the Bay of Bengal from Malaysia, fleeing persecution by Burma's military rulers. The UN reports as many as 10,000 Rohingya were killed by Burmese forces during the 2017 genocide, though some estimates put the death toll at double that number. Another 730,000 Rohingya were forced to flee Burma. In Mexico, three Honduran asylum seekers died Monday after their boat capsized off the coast of Veracruz. At least four others are missing. Another four were rescued, including a 12-year-old child. This is one of the survivors.
It is something sad, but just imagine, people won't stop trying to reach the U.S. because it's supposed to provide a better life. Don't think things are easy in our country.
This comes after a 36-year-old father from El Salvador and his 7-year-old son drowned in the Suchiate River as they attempted to cross into Mexico from Guatemala. In related news, asylum seekers trapped in the Mexican border of city of Tijuana led a protest Monday denouncing the Biden administration's use of Title 42, the Trump-era pandemic order that's been used to bar entry to over 2 million people arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border seeking refugee status. A federal judge on Friday ordered the Biden administration to continue enforcing the policy. Protesters insist they have a right under international law to claim asylum.
For us, Title 42 ends the dream of many, because in all immigrants' dreams, asylum is a right, and Title 42 takes that right away from us.
We've been here for almost a year in Tijuana. We've been in a shelter for 5 months, and we've been in a rented apartment for 5 more months, and it has been very difficult. I hope they give us support and let us enter the U.S., and we hope things there will be different, because here in Tijuana, there is also a lot of danger.
In Yemen, 3 people were killed Monday after a drone crashed into a residential neighborhood in the capital, Sana'a. Witnesses said the Saudi-led coalition drone was shot down by Houthi rebels as it circled the skies over the capital.
Unfortunately, it fell on citizens. This is a commercial market, and these are street vendors. The spy drone fell on them, and this is a violation of the 2-month truce in Yemen.
The United Nations is calling on Yemen's Houthi rebels and the Saudi-led coalition to extend the ceasefire, which is due to expire on June 1st. The World Food Program says 5 years of continuous war in Yemen has sparked the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with about 2/3 of all Yemenis, or some 20 million people, suffering from hunger and malnutrition. In Ukraine, at least one person was injured Monday as Russian forces shelled the center of Kharkiv. Residents showed reporters remnants of what appeared to be Russian cluster bombs used in the assault. Cluster munitions are banned under a global treaty that has not been ratified by Russia, Ukraine, or the United States. On Monday, the United Nations reported more than 2 million refugees have returned to Ukraine after Russian forces failed to capture major cities. On Monday, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said he's willing to negotiate an end to the war, but only through direct talks with President Vladimir Putin.
I cannot accept any kind of meeting with anyone coming from the Russian Federation but the President of the Russian Federation, and only in the case when there is one issue on the table, stopping the war. There are no other grounds for any other kind of meeting.
A veteran Russian diplomat has resigned in protest of President Putin's decision to invade Ukraine. Boris Bondarev stepped down Monday from Russia's mission to the United Nations in Geneva, writing in a scathing email to his colleagues that he's never been so ashamed of his country. His resignation letter read in part, quote, "Those who conceive this war want only one thing, to remain in power forever. Live in pompous, tasteless palaces, sail on yachts comparable in tonnage and cost to the entire Russian Navy, enjoying unlimited power and complete impunity. To achieve that, they're willing to sacrifice as many lives as it takes," the Russian official Boris Bondarev wrote. Pfizer reported Monday 3 smaller-sized doses of its COVID-19 vaccine were safe and effective at preventing symptomatic illness in children under the age of 5. Pfizer's announcement came as it prepared to submit a request for emergency use of its pediatric vaccine for U.S. children as young as 6 months old. Approval could come after the FDA convenes a panel of independent vaccine experts June 15th, when the agency will also consider Moderna's application for emergency use of its vaccine in young children. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control's warning gay and bisexual men they face an elevated risk of contracting monkeypox after public health officials identified 4 suspected cases of the viral disease in the U.S. and 1 definite one. Monkeypox is endemic to Central and West Africa and is most often spread from animals to humans. It can cause rashes and painful lesions on the body that, left untreated, can sometimes be fatal. The World Health Organization has recently identified 200 confirmed and suspected cases across a dozen countries. The WHO epidemiologist, Maria van Kerkhove, said Monday the monkeypox outbreak appears to be linked to sexual activity among men.
The transmission is really happening from close physical contact, skin-to-skin contact. So it's quite different than COVID in that sense. And the thing I just want to say here is that this is a containable situation, particularly in the countries like where we are seeing these outbreaks that are happening across Europe, in North America as well.
The Supreme Court ruled Monday two condemned prisoners in the state of Arizona cannot present new evidence in federal court that could prove they did not receive adequate legal representation leading to their convictions and death sentences. The case involves David Martinez Ramirez and Barry Lee Jones, who say their lawyers failed to present evidence that could have exonerated them. Writing for the court's 6-3 conservative majority, Justice Clarence Thomas ruled that, quote, serial relitigation of final convictions undermines the finality that is essential to both the retributive and deterrent functions of criminal law, unquote. Critics say the ruling will prevent people wrongly convicted of crimes from proving their innocence. In a scathing dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor called the decision perverse and illogical. Sotomayor wrote, quote, two men whose trial attorneys did not provide even the bare minimum level of representation required by the Constitution may be executed because forces outside of their control prevented them from vindicating their constitutional right to counsel, Justice Sotomayor wrote. Amnesty International said Monday the number of executions globally rose by at least 20% in 2021, while the number of death sentences grew by 40%. Over 500 people were executed and more than 2,000 sentenced to death last year. Executions in Saudi Arabia in 2021 more than doubled. In Georgia, former Vice President Mike Pence called Monday for Republicans to rally behind incumbent Governor Brian Kemp, who hopes to be renominated as his party's candidate in today's primary gubernatorial election.
And when you say yes to Governor Brian Kemp tomorrow, you will send a deafening message all across America that the Republican Party is the party of the future.
Governor Kemp faces a primary challenge from David Perdue, the former Republican senator backed by Donald Trump. On Monday, a Trump spokesperson criticized Pence over his endorsement of Kemp, telling the New York Times Pence was, quote, desperate to chase his lost relevance. On Monday, David Perdue threw accusations of racism after he said Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams should, quote, go back to where she came from, unquote. Abrams, who is African-American, moved to Georgia with her family in 1989. Georgia is one of five states holding primary elections today. In a closely watched race, voters in Texas's 28th congressional district will decide between Henry Cuellar, a conservative incumbent who's backed by Democratic leaders, and Jessica Cisneros, a progressive supported by Senator Bernie Sanders and Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. In January, the FBI raided the home and office of Congressmember Cuellar as part of a corruption investigation. In North Carolina, students at Bennett College, with past due tuition bills in collection, will see $1.7 million of their debts erased. The union of borrowers, known as the Debt Collective, purchased and paid off the student loans of nearly 500 black women at Bennett, a historically black, all-women liberal arts college in Greensboro. This comes as activists pressure President Biden to uphold his campaign pledge to cancel student debt, now a $1.7 trillion burden held by some 44 million people across the United States. The Washington Post reports the Justice Department will require federal agents to intervene if they see other law enforcement officers using excessive force. This is the first update to the DOJ's use of force policy in nearly two decades. This policy is scheduled to take place in July and comes after massive racial justice protests erupted in the United States and around the world in response to the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis 2 years ago this week. And a senior consultant at Shell has resigned, condemning the fossil fuel giant for expanding its oil and gas production despite mounting scientific warnings this would lead to a climate catastrophe. Carolyn Dennett worked for the company for 11 years and was based in the United Kingdom. She shared news of her resignation in a video posted on LinkedIn.
Today I'm quitting because of Shell's double talk on climate. Shell's stated safety ambition is to do no harm. It's called Goal Zero, and it sounds honourable, but they are completely failing on it. They know that continued oil and gas extraction causes extreme harms to our climate, to our environment, and to people. And whatever they say, Shell is simply not winding down on fossil fuels. They're expanding with new exploration and extraction projects against the clear warnings from scientists and dismissing the huge risks from climate change. And I just can't be a part of this anymore.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we look at The Ransom, a new series in The New York Times detailing how France devastated Haiti's economy by forcing Haiti to pay massive reparations for the loss of slave labor after enslaved Haitians rebelled, founding the world's first black republic in 1804. Back in a minute.
Mwen la, spiritualite mwen la Materialist pa jouken nan koum baka nan traka Lè pou inspirem, jojo baka rizibem Mwen nan mizik ki otantik Pale politik kritik tak nan polemik Bakite yo manipilem, kestone yo kaleje yo Yo ka ekstermine, 300 ans foun rete konsa Nou pa pe existe, se pa pesimist Fok ou realisyes, se nou pa ede yon lot La vin kapitris, ki ti nou se razine Ne kroye seven nou
Diaspora African by the Haitian musician Vax Zambou. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Hi, Amy. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, The Ransom. That's the name of a major series of articles published by The New York Times detailing how Haiti became one of the poorest countries in the world while bankers in France and the United States made a fortune. The story dates back to the early 19th century. In 1804, the enslaved people of Haiti rose up, leading a rebellion against French colonial rule, founding the world's first black republic. Under military threat from France in 1825, Haiti agreed to pay reparations to France for lost so-called property, including enslaved people that French owners lost in the rebellion. France threatened to invade Haiti and reimpose slavery if Haiti did not agree to a staggering amount in reparations, 150 million francs, 30 times Haiti's annual revenue. Haiti began taking out loans from French banks, leading to an economic crisis that continues through to this day. The New York Times estimates Haiti paid the equivalent of what's now $560 million to France over the next seven decades. The true economic cost to Haiti is estimated to be an astounding $115 billion. And that only tells a part of the story. In 1880, a French bank established Haiti's first national bank, essentially putting France in control of Haiti's treasury. That bank, Crédit Industriel et Commercial, used some of its massive profits to help finance the Eiffel Tower. The bank's current owner has just launched an investigation into its dealings with Haiti and its role in what's called the ecosystem of colonialism, that bank, CIC. The Time series also looks at the U.S. military occupation of Haiti that lasted from 1915 to 1934. A key backer of the U.S. occupation was the National City Bank of New York, the predecessor of Citibank. Former U.S. diplomat Patrick Aspar, who now heads the Center for American Progress, has called on Citigroup to pay reparations to Haiti. Gaspard wrote on Twitter, "A silent scream has been in throats for decades about the role U.S. played in depleting Haiti. No one would listen. Finally, some truths," he said. Over the years, Haitian demands for reparations have been repeatedly shut down, sometimes with force. France's former ambassador to Haiti, Thierry Boucard, admitted to the New York Times that France and the United States effectively orchestrated the 2004 coup that ousted Haiti's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Boucard said one benefit of the coup was that it ended Aristide's campaign demanding France pay financial reparations to Haiti. To talk more about Haiti and the devastating impact of colonialism in this massive series in the New York Times, we're joined by two guests. Weston Lee Alsanat is a Haitian-American professor at Fordham University, where he teaches courses on the Atlantic slave trade, the American abolition movement, and Afro-Caribbean history. Gerald Horn also joins us. He's professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Houston, author of many books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, The U.S., The Haitian Revolution, and The Origins of the Dominican Republic. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Alsanat, let's begin with you. So this series has come out in the New York Times to both criticism and praise. It's come out in both Creole and in English. That's a first for the New York Times. Can you explain the significance of what many are calling revelations, at least to the general public, but certainly people in Haiti have been alleging for centuries, not only alleging, but of course, having proof of this.
Yes. Thank you, Amy. Thank you for having me today. I'm glad to be here in conversation with you. So first, let me start by saying that a great acknowledgement to the many reporters and producers who put this very special issue together, and to have given it a front time exposure, it will mean a lot. Not really for Haitians per se, because the facts that are being revealed throughout the report are very well known, even to the most illiterate Haitian, and even to the youngest Haitian growing up. In fact, given the level of underdevelopment that is prevalent in Haiti today, one knows, at least the Haitian people knows, that this could have only been the legacy of an external force, rather of their own making. So I think the significance of the piece will be that it exposes the rest of the world to a knowledge that actually has existed for over 100 years and shares multiple partners, both in the private sector with regards to the financial industry, as well as the United States government, Germany, Great Britain, and most certainly and most influential France, having played a role in imposing the debt that in many ways will explain Haiti's poverty today. So I welcome the piece. I think it's great in terms of the many research that it brought together, both from academic literature that had already existed, as well as new revelations that are coming up. But in terms of calling it revelations, that would be a misnomer. I myself have written very extensively on the subject. Many other fellow academic historians have written about it. There have been movements over the decades to get the United States, France, and the other parties responsible for this to get them to some accountability. And I believe a large reason why this never got the fair sort of ear of listening that it should have gotten is because it's coming from Haitians, who many people view as sort of the Africans of the Western Hemisphere, but which is an identity that Haitians proudly wear wear proudly for reasons that reasonably make sense for it in terms of the freedom that they fought and established for all Black people.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Professor Gerald Horn to the conversation, another historian who has covered the issue of colonialism, imperialism, and slavery throughout the Americas for decades. I, too, had the same feeling that a lot of this is only new to people who haven't paid attention to the history of the Western Hemisphere over the last several hundred years. I'm wondering your reaction to the piece, because the Times really is delving into history much more than news. I think the most interesting aspect of it was the particular individuals in France and the institutions that directly benefited from the ransom that Haiti was forced to pay. But largely, this is history that is known by people who know any part of the history of Latin America and of the Western Hemisphere. So I'm wondering your reaction to the piece as a historian who studied this carefully.
Well, first of all, I would urge and encourage the New York Times to follow through with their point that they have uncovered new documents by putting these documents online so that other historians can take advantage of their excavations, and or secondly, placing them at the New York Times archive, which I believe has been cited at the New York Public Library. But I think that the story also is of significance and of moment for us in the United States, for we in the United States, because there has been this myth that has been created that the United States and the Haitian Revolution were twins, even though we know, as I begin my book on the Haitian Revolution, George Washington, the founding father of this country, was quite nervous about the eruption in Haiti in August 1791. And this was understandable because the Haitian Revolution, culminating in 1804, led to a general crisis of the entire slave system in the Americas that could only be resolved with its collapse. Therefore, the United States was probably second to France in being an antagonist of the Haitian people. From their point of view, this was a reaction to the fact that many of the slave revolts in the United States had Haitian fingerprints all over them. I'm speaking of Gabriel's Revolt in Virginia in 1800, the Revolt in Louisiana circa 1811, Denmark Vesey about a decade later in South Carolina. In fact, Vesey had sailed in and out of Haiti before that eruption in Charleston, South Carolina. And then culminating this hostility to Haiti, there is substantial evidence to suggest that when the island that we refer to as Hispaniola was split in 1844 with the secession from Haiti of what became the Dominican Republic, that this was an early success for U.S. covert operations. So this story in the New York Times is of significance for we in the United States. Hopefully, it will cause us to reexamine the history of this country and move away from the propaganda point that somehow the United States was an abolitionist republic when actually it was the foremost slaveholders republic.
And I'm wondering also if it wouldn't have been worthwhile for the New York Times to do another piece on its own coverage of Haiti over the past 100 years or so. I'm thinking back, for instance, during the first coup against President Aristide, when there were numerous articles in the New York Times about how Aristide was considered to be mentally unstable and erratic in his behavior, all of it fed to it by intelligence sources. And even the Times' coverage, perhaps, of the U.S. occupation, that long occupation in the early 20th century, the Times seems to be willing to go after France and the U.S., but really doesn't look at its own role in creating the narrative of Haiti as a dysfunctional country. I'm wondering what you think about that, Gerald.
Well, you're absolutely correct. Obviously, criticism should be accompanied by self-criticism, and there is much work to be done in that sphere by the New York Times. You mentioned the occupation 1915 to 1934. The New York Times did not necessarily stress and emphasize in their coverage the mass opposition to the U.S. occupation, particularly by Black Americans, particularly by a founder of the NAACP, speaking of W.E.B. Du Bois, who, as you know, his ancestral roots were, in fact, on the island, and he led a vigorous campaign against this murderous and bloodthirsty occupation that in some ways involved the reassertion of unpaid labor, the so-called corvée, as it was called euphemistically in Haiti. And the New York Times would do well to reexamine its own coverage, because hopefully that would improve today's coverage.
Well, I want to go back to 2004. Juan just referred to this. France's former ambassador to Haiti has admitted France and the United States effectively orchestrated the 2004 coup that overthrew Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president. The former French ambassador, Thierry Boucard, told the New York Times one benefit of the coup was that it ended Aristide's campaign demanding France pay reparations to Haiti. I want to turn to an interview we did with Kim Ives of Haiti Liberté. This was right after President Aristide was put on a plane and sent to the Central African Republic. This was what Kim Ives described.
This is a U.S.-French-led operation. In fact, didn't Aristide say he holds the French ambassador to Haiti as well responsible for his kidnapping and wants to bring charges?
Yes, the French were involved in all this pressure and, in fact, were in some ways leading the charge. This was a purely U.S.-French operation.
And of course, France, probably more than the United States, had more to lose from Aristide continuing in the presidency, since he was beginning to lay claim to reparations from
right.
France for the period of colonialism and slavery.
Well, this is precisely it. You had the restitution for $21.7 billion, which was on the table. And we saw a lot of rivalries were put aside to get Aristide out between the ruling groups in Haiti. You have the Comprador bourgeoisie and the big landowners, who generally are constantly squabbling throughout Haitian history for power. They put aside their differences to get together, which we see with Andy Appel representing the bourgeoisie and Guy Philippe and Jodel Chamblain, more the Macoute wing. And we saw the France and the U.S., who have also been sort of vying, put aside their differences. So you saw this unity come between rivals against Aristide because he represented the people and because he was a representative of popular will in Haiti.
So just to be clear, this is mid-March 2004 that Kim Ives was speaking. Right after that, Democracy Now!, I flew to the Central African Republic on a small plane covering a group of African-American activists and politicians, including Randall Robinson of TransAfrica, as well as Congressmember Maxine Waters, who went to the Central African Republic to retrieve the Aristides and then brought them back to the Western Hemisphere, as the U.S. government was saying, how dare you bring them to this hemisphere? To which Randall Robinson responded, whose hemisphere? They eventually brought them to Haiti, and the Aristides then went into exile in South Africa for years before they eventually went back to Haiti, where they are today. I'd like to get response, starting with Professor Horn and then Professor Alsanat, about the significance of these coups, whether we're talking about Aristide in the early 90s or again in 2004, the coups against them and what that meant for this country. I mean, no president again would demand reparations.
Well, the reparations question is obviously key. Keep in mind that what makes the United States unique is that the slave owners were expropriated. Their property and the bodies of enslaved Africans was taken without compensation. That helped to give rise to the terrorism of the Ku Klux Klan. In Haiti, as we've been discussing, the Haitians were obligated to pay back, believe it or not, the enslavers. And likewise, if you look at the British possessions, so-called Jamaica, Barbados, etc., you had London compensate the enslavers, and by some measures, that total was not paid off until just a few years ago. And so this question of reparations is quite key, and also quite key is the role of Haiti in helping to ignite this entire process of abolition, leading to capital loss, not least in the United States of America. The enslaving class and their descendants have a very long memory. They have not forgotten Haiti's role. That's why they continue to punish Haiti for having the temerity to rise up against slavery. And even today, they continue to punish Haiti because they see Haiti as a haven for low-wage labor. U.S. baseballs and the U.S. national pastime are largely manufactured by cheap labor in Haiti. So there is still much to sort out with regard to this entire controversy.
And Professor Alsanat, if you could also respond right through today to the U.S. diplomat Patrick Gaspard, who now runs Center for American Progress, demanding Citibank launch an investigation, and the whole issue of reparations, whether you could see it actually being real, given the devastation of Haiti.
Okay, thank you, Amy. I think I want to quickly go back to what was asked with regards to the New York Times. Let me remind our audience that it was in 2010, not just days after an earthquake had devastated the country and killed upwards of 200,000 and more people, that the New York Times provided a platform for one of its columnists, David Brooks, to say some of the most racist things that I've ever read in the New York Times about Haiti. So if we are going to also give the New York Times the credit for what is a phenomenal job about talking on this issue, they should also start by apologizing for what Mr. Brooks had said then, which, let me quote real quick, "Haiti, like most of the world's poorest nations, suffers from a complex web of progress-resistant cultural influences. There is the influence of the voodoo religion, which spreads the message that life is capricious and planning futile. There are high levels of social mistrust. Responsibility is often not internalized. Child-rearing practices often involve neglect in the early years and harsh retribution when kids hit 9 or 10. We're all supposed to politely respect each other's cultures, but some cultures are more progress-resistant than others, and a horrible tragedy was just exacerbated by one of them." So I call on the New York Times to both acknowledge the statements of racist demagoguery on its pages from Mr. David Brooks. As anyone can judge for themselves, they can go back and look at the op-ed and its pseudo intellectual anthropologizing of Haitians. So that's one. And with regards to Mr. Gaspar, I believe he actually served in the Obama administration. And most people should know that President Obama, being himself the first Black African-American president of the United States, actually never made an official visit to the first Black republic in the world, the very nation without which Mr. Obama would have not assumed the role of leading a society like the United States as he had. So I would like to know from Mr. Gaspar, why is that the administration never actually took the very official position that he is taking right now with regards to Haitian poverty and underdevelopment, and the explicit role that the United States, France, Canada, and Germany have played in all of that. And then lastly, I just want to respond to your question with regards to just the immensity of the debt and the destructive legacy it has had for Haiti. The tragedy of all of this is that even once this debt is paid, if it were to ever be paid, which I, like Professor Horn, I believe there are parties that are invested in never actually making realizing that possibility. Even if that debt were to be paid, we are already talking about decades of gaps in development that were missed in the process because of where the money was going. Something like upwards to 80% of all Haitian expenditures up until
the early part of the 20th century was going to financing the debt. And the fact that American firms from Wall Street and cahoots with the federal government in terms of the State Department, the Navy, and you have names like General Smedley Butler, who actually wrote about his role as a Marines in Haiti and how he secured the interests of the financial corporate groups, as well as working with the State Department to make sure that Haiti becomes a haven for capitalism, as he said. And also, we can even see FDR, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, himself had been Secretary of the Navy upon the time that Haiti was invaded and becoming a protectorate, essentially, of the United States. And he, too, had professed to actually amending the Haitian Constitution to take out a very revolutionary constitutional clause that had banned white males from owning land in Haiti. Among the first constitutional clauses that the occupation targeted was that, and therefore opened the country up to internal meddling by the international powers. But lastly, I just want to also note the fact that with regards to what you had said about the Eiffel Tower, Credit Industrial, which is now a part of Credit Agricole, one of the largest banks in the world, I think among the 10th largest banks in the world, having funded the building of the Eiffel Tower, which is now this massive monument to French industrial prowess. That it was happening at a moment in which the United States, France, Germany, and parts of Western Europe were developing rapidly from the capital that they were extracting from many of their former colonies or their current colonies. So imagine what would the history of development in Haiti be today if at the same time that the world is undergoing industrial transformations, the likes of which we see today in the form of the Eiffel Tower. What if that money that was taken from Haiti, financing French infrastructure, was financing Haitian infrastructure instead? The fact of the matter is there is no progress-resistant genes that somehow Haitians are born with. Perhaps someone like David Brooks was born with that, with some progress-resistant gene, as he is unable to fathom that Haitians can take care of themselves. But the truth goes to show where the receipts are in terms of why we know Haiti is in the position that it is today.
Well, I'd like to ask Gerald Horn, the bank aspect of this reporting, which I think the most newsworthy in that the Times actually was able to get a hold in French archives of financial arrangements that were made between banking interests in France and Haiti, as well as it's uncovering or more deeply uncovering the role of First National City Bank in the early 20th century in Haiti. So I think that this is some of the best stuff in this report. But it's almost like, hey, New York Times discovers imperialism. isn't the role of Wall Street and European banks in controlling the economies, not just of Haiti, but of Honduras, of Nicaragua, of Cuba, of many of these countries in Latin America, part of the operational mode of American imperialism?
Most definitely. And I think that the series, laudable as it has been, could also have made a contribution if it had pointed out the close connections between France and the United States. That is to say, in the 20th century, they began to talk about the Citibank and Citicorp and how it was involved in the depredations inflicted upon Haiti. But I think that if you were to go back to the Haitian Revolutionary period, you would also find similar connections. After all, we know that what became the United States was involved in a revolt against London that would not have succeeded without the assistance of France. We know that there was substantial French migration to the United States, and that the Frenchmen were involved in similar depredations in Louisiana and slave owning, for example. We know that when Texas seceded from Mexico in 1836, that Texas's major diplomatic ally on the international front happened to be France. And we also know that when the United States Civil War erupted 1861 to 1865, it was France that opportunistically chose that moment to try to seize and occupy Mexico and then extend the lease on life of slavery in Texas and throughout the South by welcoming slave owners from Texas and from Dixie into French-occupied Mexico. And it took a mass revolt by the Mexican people to overturn that particular scheme. So there is much more digging and excavation that needs to be done. And I would like to reiterate my call for the New York Times to open the kimono and to disgorge these documents they say that they have uncovered in France so that other scholars and other researchers can examine same.
We haven't even talked about the Louisiana Purchase, but we can't in this show. However, I want to end on the crisis that Haitians confront today when they try to come into the United States. I think it was last September the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti resigned in protest over the Biden administration's policies. In a letter, the longtime diplomat, U.S. Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, wrote, "I will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees." Foote also criticized the Biden administration for meddling in Haiti's political affairs, including its support for Ariel Henry as prime minister following the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moise in July. Foote's resignation came just days after U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback were filmed chasing, grabbing, and whipping Haitian asylum seekers who'd gathered in that makeshift camp in Del Rio, Texas. We only have a minute, Professor Alsinat, but the issue of Haitian refugees being deported by the thousands back to a devastated Haiti.
Oh, well, real quick, I think what you've just demonstrated is that Haiti stands as a singular metaphor for understanding the racial legacy of imperial powers like the United States and France. In fact, as the war in Ukraine is happening, the sheer magnitude of the difference in the treatment of certain refugees because of their European background relative to, say, Haitians, as you just showed in terms of what's happening at the border. That's a very revealing example of what Haiti not only means to the United States, but what it means to the world at large in terms of populations from formerly colonized geographies, as well as Black, Brown, and Indigenous people in this country who knows something about the treatment of racism at the hands of the U.S. government. So in many ways, Haiti should be looked at as a singular metaphor for explaining so many of these various mistreatments and levels of preference for different groups. And I think the more we learn about Haiti, the more we realize how our fate, and this is not an overstatement, our fate is actually directly connected to it if we are going to better understand what world we're living in with regards to how the powers that be intend to engineer the world towards imperialism.
Our fates intertwined, going right back to the U.S. not recognizing Haiti's independence for decades, fearing that a slave uprising would inspire enslaved people in the United States to rise up. Weston Lee Alsinat, thanks so much for being with us. Haitian-American professor at Fordham University, where he teaches courses on the Atlantic slave trade, the American abolition movement, and Afro-Caribbean history. And thank you, Gerald Horn, professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Houston, author of many books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, The U.S., The Haitian Revolution, and The Origins of the Dominican Republic. Next up, in his first trip to Asia as president, Joe Biden's promise to defend Taiwan militarily if it's invaded by China. Is this new U.S. policy? Stay with us.
Paper tiger. You paper tigers are all alike. Your roar is much worse than your bite. Quit spying and sighing and lying and trying to be.
Paper Tiger by Sue Thompson. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Biden's in Tokyo on his first trip to Asia while in office to meet with members of the Quad. That's the prime ministers of Japan, India, and the new prime minister of Australia as part of efforts to counter China's power in the region. China's called the Quad a, quote, Indo-Pacific NATO and accused it of, quote, trumpeting the Cold War mentality and stoking geopolitical rivalry. This comes as India's prime minister, Narendra Modi, has resisted U.S. pressure to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Tensions also hung over the Quad summit since Monday when Biden contradicted longstanding U.S. policy on Taiwan, vowing to defend Taiwan if it's attacked by China. He made the comment when questioned at a news conference.
You didn't want to get involved in the Ukraine conflict militarily for obvious reasons. Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's the commitment we made. That's a commitment we made. We are not. Look, here's the situation. We agree with a one China policy. We signed on to it and all the attendant agreements made from there. But the idea that it can be taken by force, just taken by force, is just not appropriate. It will dislocate the entire region and be another action similar to what happened in Ukraine.
White House officials tried to walk back Biden's comments, as they've done before, but Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Biden's comment highlighted our commitment under the Taiwan Relations Act to help provide Taiwan the means to defend itself. Today, Biden was again asked about Taiwan. This time, he insisted there's been no change to U.S. policy.
Mr. President, is the policy of strategic ambiguity towards Taiwan dead?
No.
Could you explain?
No.
Mr. President, would you send troops to Taiwan if China invaded?
Our policy has not changed at all. I stated that when I made my statement yesterday.
For more, we're joined by Michael Swain, director of the Quincy Institute's East Asia program, longtime U.S.-China relations analyst. His books and briefings include Remaining Aligned on the Challenges Facing Taiwan. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael Swain. Why don't you start off by responding to the significance of what Biden has said? By the way, not just yesterday and clearly very deliberately, but he has repeated this several times. And then China's accusation that the Quad, this group of four countries that are meeting, Australia, India, Japan, and the United States, are an Indo-Pacific NATO.
Great. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah. President Biden has spoken now, I think it's the fourth time he said something like he said yesterday, that the United States is committed to come to the security of Taiwan, implication being that if Taiwan were attacked by China. This, if he meant that exact meaning, it is literally not in line with U.S. policy. U.S. policy states that the United States would regard with grave concern, any attack on Taiwan, and the president would consult with the Congress on what exactly to do about it. That is in U.S. law. There's no commitment to deploy forces as if Taiwan were a security ally of the United States, which it is not. But there is a commitment to provide defensive articles to Taiwan, i.e. military sales, as the United States judges the security situation becoming more threatening for Taiwan. And the U.S. has been providing those military sales now for many, many years. But this idea that the United States is obligated to come to the defense of Taiwan if attacked is simply not U.S. policy. U.S. policy is what's called strategic ambiguity. It doesn't want to be clear on this issue because, A, it doesn't want to provide what you might call a blank check to Taiwan through possibly endless types of salami slicing or provocation that the U.S. would then need to come to the defense of Taiwan to sort of bail them out of a problem. And also, such language reinforces Beijing's impression that the U.S. is revising its policy and viewing Taiwan as a de facto security partner and an independent nation. And this would absolutely undermine the one China policy that the United States has held now for many decades. Under that policy, it traded a credible U.S. one China stance that did not challenge the Chinese position that Taiwan is part of China. It traded that for a Chinese assurance to pursue peaceful unification as a top priority, while not completely giving up the possibility of using force, but not putting that as a top priority. Now, both sides have this understanding as the basis of normalization. And it's being steadily weakened now by both sides, and President Biden's recent comment weakens it even further.
Well, Michael Swain, I wanted to ask you, when you talk about this strategic ambiguity, this policy, could you talk about a little bit about the origins of it in terms of there was a period of time after the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949 when the U.S. tried to ostracize and not recognize the existence of the People's Republic and saw the nationalists in Taiwan as the legitimate rulers of all of China. Could you talk about the change that occurred back during the Nixon years and the possible implications of President Biden attempting to change that policy?
Yes. I mean, the change occurred back during the Nixon period in the early 1970s with the so-called opening to China, when Nixon flew to Beijing and met with Mao Zedong, met with Zhou Enlai. And then later on, several years later on, actual formal diplomatic relations were normalized in 1979, and the United States transferred its recognition from Beijing, from Taiwan to Beijing, having Beijing, the People's Republic of China, being the sole government of China. Now, that happened because of largely strategic reasons at the time. The Soviet Union had become the adversary of both the United States and the People's Republic of China. And President Nixon thought it would be a much better strategic thing for the United States to have good relations with China as it developed relations or tried to develop relations with Russia, rather than have Russia and China have good relations. So both China and the United States had a common interest in working with each other to try to maneuver against, counter, exert leverage against the Soviet Union at that time. So that's the origins of the shift. But Nixon also wanted to have contact with China because he thought it was ridiculous to be shunning a billion people, or I guess at that time it was less than a billion people, 800 million people on the planet for many decades, as we had done, and that it was serving no positive purpose, and that we needed to have a normal relationship with the People's Republic of China. So for Taiwan, although we ended diplomatic relations with Taiwan and no longer regarded Taiwan as a government that represented China and that was a sovereign, independent state, we acknowledged, without formally recognizing, but we acknowledged and did not challenge the Chinese position that Taiwan is a part of China. And so we also established relations with Taiwan, but unofficial relations, non-diplomatic relations, which included contacts in the economic, social, cultural level, some degree of governmental level, but not through diplomatic means. And then
we have 10 seconds, Michael.
Then the sale of arms. So we have this kind of a balance now that the United States has tried to keep in its relations with Taiwan, which is now fraying badly.
Well, this is something We will continue to cover Michael Swain, director of the Quincy Institute's East Asia program, longtime U.S.-China relations analyst. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Shirina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon, Juan Carlos Davila. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.